All veranda staterooms. Every day, a new view. Viking, offering a small ship experience on the world's oceans and a shore excursion in every port. Viking, exploring the world in comfort. Learn more at viking.com.
It's harvest time again in Cornwall, and crops aren't the only bounty at the table this season. Romance, both new and old, is blooming.
Perhaps I have hidden talents.
I don't dispute that. For somehow you managed to bring the light back to Francis's eyes.
I cannot imagine how.
Can you not?
You should go to bed, Ross. Demelza will be thinking you've gone astray.
Ross and Demelza, meanwhile, prepare to welcome another new child to Nampara by selling most of their worldly possessions. Ross's steep loan interests waits for no mine.
I write to remind you that your loan of £1,000 with interest at 40% is shortly due for repayment. Your friend, Harris Pascoe.
I'm Barrett Brontës, and this is Mining Poldark, a podcast from Masterpiece, exploring the beloved PBS series. We'll cover quite a lot of ground this episode as Ross rekindles old flames, Demelza rejects a variety of unwanted suitors, and Caroline Penvenon digs in for another go at the skilled and all too serious Dr. Dwight Ennis. I'm thrilled to be joined, as always, by my co-host, Robin Ellis, the original Ross Poldark from our 1970s adaptation of the series. Hi, Robin.
Hello, Barrett.
We'll start off with a blow-by-blow of this juicy episode and then share our key big scenes from the episode, too.
It's harvest time, and there's a bumper yield in this episode. After the tensions and tears of the trial, we are entering a new phase of the saga. There's rich pickings, as Judd would say, and he says a lot here. He reaps what he sowed at the trial when he reneged on his pledge to lie about Ross and is left for dead by George's henchmen.
But psych, he's not dead. And Prudy's brief widowhood and his resurrection are played for laughs. An even happier resurrection occurs in Francis, who has a new and delightful lease on life. He's like Ebenezer Scrooge on Christmas morning. And in his tossing of hay, his tussling of Geoffrey Charles's hair, and the spark in his eye, we have forgiven him everything.
Ross and Demelza, facing imminent penury, are forced to sell almost all, bar the kitchen sink, to meet the interest payment on the loan. This seems to reunite them, though she has yet to tell him she's pregnant again. Dwight and Caroline continue their merry dance, with Caroline leading, dressed in the reddest coat ever seen in Cornwall.
Ross's intoxication with Elizabeth inexplicably occurs and has him singing pretty after-hours what-ifs about a millimeter away from her as poor Demelza listens in the shadows outside the door. When she sobs out the news of the coming baby shortly after, he expresses his willingness to risk his heart, giving us hope once again.
And what is Ross looking at in the distance as he returns to Nampara with a cart full of hay and a mind full of financial worries weighing heavily on him? It could be Wheel Grace, the Poldark mine closed over 50 years ago. Perhaps the future lies there, deep in its waterlogged depths.
Oh boy, that's good. You've done an amazing job synthesizing it all because a lot happened in this episode. So I've learned that you and I share one of our favorite moments from the episode, and I can't wait to find out which one it is. So let's have you kick off and start us off.
Okay, well, mine is a part of quite a long sequence, and it's I call it the sale of acids.
Yes. And it's good.
Which is a slightly technical-sounding phrase, but it's actually what it is, really.
We have, however, a more pressing concern. Last year, I asked Pascoe to find me a loan of £1,000. The interest of 40% is due this week.
£400?
Yes.
How is half such a sum to be found? What's to be done?
Ride to Truro. See if Pascoe's managed to get the loan extended for another year. In the meantime,
the more I work in the mine, the better our chances of reaching Trevorgi.
And the interest?
Look about you. See what you can bear to part with. then look again.
It's got the cart ride into the town and the selling off of everything and people looking at them on the cart in public, you know, the shame of it all, and then this shot of them leaving the little town and going back with an empty cart.
Yes.
It's got everything. But in just before all that happens, there's a scene where Ross and Demelza walk in the woods near the house and have a chat. And it's sort of quite early on. And the atmosphere between them has been pretty tense, not very happy, really. But somehow this crisis that they find themselves in unites them in this intimate walk through the woods. And it's very touching. And humor often brings them together. And they list the possible assets that they have that would have to be put up for sale. And it's sort of a nice intimate scene between them where they show their love really through humor and an acceptance of what they have to do. And they go off and do it. And it's a touching sequence.
I think it's wonderful. I completely agree. And you do see how it does bring them together.
Yeah.
And I like that encounter when they were in town with George, and you see that Demelza helps Ross out of that before it escalates. You know, it's very good. Their partnership is sometimes strongest when times are toughest, or at least so far.
Yeah.
So far.
This emphasizes that. And I agree about the little meeting with George, which is quite dangerous. And it has to be said that Ross obeys. I mean, he doesn't pursue this time.
Yep.
And is led away from George just before it all explodes.
Ross, how are you? Oh, you don't look at all well. Can it be the anxieties of the trial?
Nor you, George. Could you have had some disappointment?
None that I know of.
Perhaps it is yet to come.
Ross.
And that means a lot, because he could feel very humiliated right at this moment, you know, having to sell everything, and yet he still doesn't take George's bait. That's pretty upstanding. So I'm going to remember that later when we evaluate his hero-ness.
Good. Yes. I've been evaluating that. It's been coming and going, actually, but it's looking not too bad.
Let's take a quick break before our next scene to hear a word from our sponsors.
Coming up next on Masterpiece on PBS, Mr. Bates versus the Post Office continues Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, followed by the finale of Alice and Jack at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Central.
What's next? What do you have next?
This is number two. It's called The Scene Over the Body of Judd. And it's funny because I do you remember, Henry V, I think, by Shakespeare. And it immediately reminded me of Mistress Quickly's speech over Falstaff's body. It's the only time Falstaff makes an appearance in Henry V, and he's dead, basically. But she has this famous speech in reminiscing about him and how he did babble of green fields. And, you know, Falstaff's an equally doubtful character in many ways, rather like Judd.
Yes.
And Prudy's reaction is very much come, you know, hot and cold, really.
Who could have done such a thing? He had no enemies. He was the sweetest, kindliest, most peaceable cove a body could meet. And ne'er a crossword did pass his lips. And now I left a widow, all forlorn, without a penny in the world. Not even to bury the poor soul, God rest it.
There is this. When we moved him, they fell out of his pockets.
Gold sovereigns? Gold sovereigns? Where'd he get such?
Where indeed?
Why, the misery, muzzly, stinging black worm. He had him about him and never told me.
Reckon it is from the trade. It's unlikely.
I'll knock him sideways down Stibby Stabby Lane. Then give him a rare good burying. Rum and victuals. Hymns and vials. Widow's weeds for poor old Prudy. 'Tis a matter of looking respectable, 'tis. We must send the old man off 50 ways.
And the scene continues with another talk between Ross and Melza. Well, Ross is, he's very sympathetic because he's known Judd since he was a small boy.
I'd known him since I was a child. He was the most useless servant under the sun. But he taught me how to smoke a pipe and cheat at loo.
It's a rich little scene and very nicely done, I think. And you know, Prudy gets a really good chance in this scene. And that's why I chose it, really. Because Judd gets a lot of chances early on. He's not silent. He's a big talker in this one. Very amusing talker as well. But he's just lying for the moment anyway, prone on the bench.
Her language is wonderful. It's so rich and delightful.
It is.
You just would love to sort of pull out all these moments, and usually these greatest moments of language with her occur when she's angry at Judd.
Yes, yes.
But they're fantastic, and she swings wildly from one emotion to another and one sort of external pose to another. And I guess in a way I thought, oh, that's just a lovely comic delight. But in a way, I think that there maybe is some emotional truth to that, too, that when someone is grieving, they are swinging wildly, you know, back and forth because grief is complicated. So it is. It's all around really nice stuff.
And it reflects their relationship, I think, which, is, you know, has certainly been not a smooth one, might say, but a loving one in the end, I think.
Another thing I like about your choice of that scene is that funeral feast or that wake parallels the other two feasts that are occurring at the same time.
It does, very much so, yes. There are three feasts, and it's harvest festivals in a way, the two of them, and this one is mirrors them in a sense. You're right. It's a nice balance, yeah.
Okay, so for my first moment, we're going to go back to the time before Ross and Demelza sort of reconciled and went on that walk that you talked about, when Ross was getting more and more stressed out over his debt, but he hadn't yet told Demelza everything, I think. He hadn't revealed it yet. Mm-hmm. And she, in turn, was becoming more and more stressed about this pregnancy that she hasn't told him about yet and not having the opportunity and not taking the opportunities when she's had it. So McNeil shows up, comes in, has a drink by the fire with Demelza, and says that Bedruggan wants her to come and help heal his sick cow, which we later know is just a ruse to get her over there.
Did you mislay your manners? Leave me alone to deal with our guest.
You appeared to be handling him admirably. I felt like an intruder.
Meaning what?
Demelza, do you really suppose he wants you to cure Bedruggan's cow? He makes his intentions very plain.
I think I ought to be able to judge that for myself.
No doubt you think so. Just be careful his uniform doesn't dazzle you. It has that effect on some people.
Especially a common miner's daughter who don't know any better.
Well, that's for you to demonstrate.
You are detestable saying that.
I'm sure I didn't start this argument.
No, but you never do. You just give me the cold shoulder and sour looks and despise everything that isn't up to your high and mighty standards.
So I loved this moment between them because they're really just bickering about nothing. And what I love so much about this is that it is just sort of a classic marriage argument where the man is baffled by how this even transpired. How did I get into this position? Why are we both mad at each other? They are both very stressed out, and they're bringing that, each of their own stresses, to this interaction and just having a bicker. So I thought there was some real truth to that, and that's what I loved about that moment.
I think you're absolutely right. It reflected the frustration they're both feeling at the moment. She with him for being off and non-communicative with her. You know, they've come back from the trial, a really hugely stressful emotional time, and he's suddenly gone into a kind of mood. And, you know, it's just too bad. It's too bad. She wants to communicate with him. Of course she wants to tell him that she's pregnant, and the time isn't right.
My next moment that I wanted to talk with you about was this absolutely beautiful scene of the ceremony that's called Crying the Neck. This is this harvest ceremony, and it begins with a view over the hills of grain underneath the most clear blue sky. You see the harvesters advancing. And then you see that it's Francis and Elizabeth in this beautiful, like, idyllic setting with industry and love and nature, all of these different things coming together. And then in come Ross and Demelza, and you have this incredible reconciliation, and then a really wonderful ceremony where they're celebrating the harvest and the bounty. And again, it's one of those things that makes you feel as you're watching it, like there's this real authenticity to it, that you're looking at something that probably went on for hundreds of years that doesn't happen anymore. And so there's just like a real opportunity to get to experience something from that time period. It was wonderful.
I totally agree. And it's my third scene as well. I thought it was a remarkable bucolic scene of reconciliation. I mean, it includes the meeting and shaking of hands of Ross and Francis, a true reconciliation, mm-hmm. really very truthful, and ends with this extraordinary traditional. And I believe that they do, traditional societies in Cornwall still celebrate in this way.
Cousin, it's an unexpected pleasure.
Thank you for bringing him. It means the world to Francis.
You look well, cousin.
Demelza.
Francis.
Welcome.
I haven't.
Wally!
A neck!
Hurrah! Hurrah! Hurrah!
Oh. You see, when Francis is holding it above his head, you know, crying, a neck, you see his sort of just this pure happiness and sort of humility in him. It's wonderful. And then that handing it to his son, so it's passing it along. You know, I had an opportunity to ask Debbie Horsfield about this ceremony, and she told me that it wasn't specifically in the book. They were filming in Cornwall at the beginning of September, which is the harvest season. So even though the incidents in the book take place at Christmas, they decided to work with what they had, which was fields of grain that were just harvested in this like balmy, warm weather. So they were looking around at traditional Cornish rituals and ceremonies that might fit the story and bring the characters together in this sort of celebratory kind of way. And their Cornish advisor and their 18th century historical advisor suggested from among various Cornish traditions this festival called Crying the Neck. So that's what they used. And I loved that they used the setting that they were in rather than imposing something on it. So again, you just have that great feeling of authenticity, and you can almost just like smell the heat of the hay, you know, and feel the warmth of the sun. It's wonderful. I loved it.
It fits so well with the narrative, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. It's terrific. All right. So then on to my third favorite scene, or the third scene which I responded very emotionally to, because I can't really say it's my favorite scene. It's very upsetting.
Oh.
It's the scene with Ross and Elizabeth at the end of the episode, after everyone's gone to bed, or so they think, and they're just having a nice, friendly conversation among cousins that changes. And the old flame comes up again, and he starts to feel that desire again for her. So our triangle becomes set up once again, our love triangle. And he disappoints me tremendously when he starts sort of flirting with her, or just using a really inappropriate intimacy. It happens very gradually in this scene.
Today in the fields, you looked like a girl of 16. Your age when I first knew you.
These past months have changed me. Has made me appreciate what I have rather than what I lack.
It's very wise. After all, there's no point thinking about what might have been.
But you and I would never have been happy together. Our characters are too different.
True. But cannot love overcome such obstacles? And surely there's a greater impediment. You're a lady. You could never play the scullery maid.
Perhaps I have hidden talents.
Jamelza is in the hallway and she hears this. I mean, that's just gutting. And meanwhile, she's hearing this like while she's carrying the secret that she's pregnant with their child and her worry that he doesn't want this child. So this is terrible. He is literally about to kiss her. You can tell that he's about to kiss her. And then she sort of puts an end to it, thankfully, and they both go their separate ways. But the damage has been done. That door has been opened. That flame has been rekindled. And Demelza's insecurity has been justified. So off we go. Off we go.
Poor Demelza's insecurity, as you say, reawakened in a major way. And why not, actually? And I have to say, Elizabeth behaves extraordinarily correctly in this scene.
Yep.
You know, in our game of Ross 1 to 10, he was doing pretty well up to this point, I have to say. He had a bit of...
He was. That can be inscribed on his tombstone. He was doing pretty well up to this point.
Up to this point.
Right.
Having had a little bit of a rickety start, but nevertheless, he'd been pretty good. And then, wow, I'm not sure how to mark him, but he certainly took a dive here.
He did.
It's a devastating scene. And you just think, no, don't. Please don't do this. Don't do this. You know, you've come so far. Things are looking up. You've made it up with Francis. You'll get your own back on George because you've got a really good idea. You know, you've got an idea for the future so that you
That's
might
right.
be free of George and his machinations. This is old ground. This is old history. Do not reawaken it. Do not go down that path. And sure enough, he does. Because it wouldn't have happened. I think Dwight's called away, isn't he, from the dinner party? And they're left alone. Is that the scene? Maybe it's an earlier scene.
It is. No, I think you're right.
No.
I blame Caroline.
Absolutely, yes. Well, we haven't mentioned Caroline, golly. But I agree. It's a very good choice, actually, because it's a tricky emotional choice, in fact. A brave choice, Barrett. Great. Very good.
Thank you. But I, you know, once again, I have to ask you, Robin, why do you think this happened? What was it in him?
Well, I mean, one has to say the spark is still there, I suppose. And with opportunity and quite a lot of drink at the end of a meal. But... gosh, it's too dangerous and emotionally too dangerous and very unfair on Elizabeth and on Demelza, of course. But there you go.
Yeah.
He is a flawed character.
He is. We have to accept it. I'm disappointed. You know, I'm going to be like a mother. Ross, I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed.
Oh, yeah, that wonderful line. I love that line. I'm not angry. Yes, it's a great line.
Right?
Yes.
So I guess in that light, I'm going to downgrade him from last week, and I'm going to give him a 3.5.
Well, he was doing pretty well, as I say. You know, he was kind of 7.5, and I think I have to put him down to, 4.
Okay.
Well,
wow.
Okay, I'll stick to 4 anyway.
Yeah.
I'll stick to 4, but... No, I mean, he should be off the scale, really. I mean...
I don't know. I do feel like, yes, you know, he did resist George sort of teasing him, and he did apologize to Demelza for his behavior. But it's too much. I have... This has a greater weight. It's terrible.
Okay. I'm going to revise. Down 2.5, I give him.
Oh, yep. No, he's really
two
down the mine. I don't know.
2.5.
I don't know if he's ever going to get out.
Sorry, Ross.
Well, as always, it's been a delight to talk with you. I've appreciated it so much.
Me too, Barrett. It's been lovely. Thank you very much indeed. And à la prochaine fois. Till the next time.
Now, as much as we might love to hate George Warleggan, Jack Farthing, the actor who plays him, is a true delight in real life. Let's listen to a bit of his conversation with my colleague, Jace Lacob, on our companion podcast, Masterpiece Studio.
What did you make of the character of George Borlegen when you first read the scripts for season one?
I mean, he's pretty appealing. I went for him. I fell for him pretty quick. I think he's a really interesting, complicated, nuanced character, full of troubles and insecurities, and he felt real and interesting, and a sort of some way off from who I think I am in real life. So he felt like a challenge and something I wanted to sort of jump at.
I feel like there's a world in which George is the hero of this show somewhere.
He's the hero of his show, that's for sure.
His own show.
Yeah.
Were you familiar at all with Winston Graham's Poldark novels or the original 1970s adaptation?
I wasn't. I think I was of a generation just that wasn't quite given it. Obviously, having read Debbie Horsfield's scripts and had a little look online, I dived into the books, and I sort of haven't really looked at the original series. I've looked at tiny clips, but I've kind of kept my distance because, you know, in an attempt to make something new, not to get distracted by what came before. But the books I love very much, and I'm reading them as we film the series and taking lots of things. You know, they are wonderful treasure troves of information for someone who wants to play one of those characters.
The first time we meet George Borlegen is in the first episode, where George congratulates Ross, quote, on the scratch, and he tries to make it seem like these two men are similar. Ross is right off the bat so cruel to George. Should we feel bad for George initially?
Well, I'd love to think that somebody out there does. I don't know. I mean, I think he sometimes behaves in a way that makes him difficult to feel sorry for. But I feel sorry for him. I think, you know, I think he has a lot of chips on his shoulder that he can't quite, you know, rid himself of. I think absolutely. I think Ross is, you know, for all Ross's good points, he's very proud. He's very stubborn. And he refuses to accept anything that George offers, even though, you know, many of the offers that George throws at Ross are sort of sensible ones. And another man in Ross's position who didn't have the feelings that Ross has towards George might jump at them. I think, you know, throughout series one and into series two, there are moments when George does try and reach out to Ross, and he can see a world in which they can work together. But at the end of the day, both of them have such, you know, long-seated resentment that it's going to be very difficult to work together.
I mean, as much as he seems to hate Ross, he also seems to want to be him.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think he does. I mean, you know, there's lots about Ross that George does absolutely detest. But he, as I said, you know, he has so much that George wants. So I think there are definitely aspects and elements of Ross that George does want to have in him and sort of, you know, can't possibly get.
Can you tease what's coming up for George and his Poldark rivals?
He's definitely allowing himself to be in Ross's face much more. He potentially gets a bit rasher. There's less thought, there's more action, which allows for more, you know, more drama, more conflict. But again, as I've said, I think emotionally he's growing as well, and you see more of that. So I think he's expanding as a person. It's like spending more time with someone, you know, you just get to know them more.
How does it feel to play the character that people love to hate?
I mean, it's lovely. It's lovely. It's, you know, if people love to do anything with George, it's my privilege. It's nice because I have there's a place in the stories for him. You know, he represents something quite specific. He is, you know, the show's biggest antagonist in a way. And it's lovely. And I think, I haven't received any horrible hate mail or it's just been nice. People have been really nice about it. So I think, you know, we were lucky that to an extent the show has captured, you know, something. People seem to like it, and hopefully they will continue to.
That was Poldark star Jack Farthing speaking with Masterpiece Studio host Jace Lacob. You can listen to the rest of their conversation and many more interviews with his Poldark castmates besides at our website, pbs.org/masterpiece studio, or on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Radio Public, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Next time on Mining Poldark, a new baby at Nampara and new partnerships galore.
You're hateful!
You're infuriating!
I could crown you!
By all means, once you've delivered our child.
We'll meet baby Jeremy and continue to root for Caroline and Dwight on the next episode. And you can join us in our rewatching adventure here on Mining Poldark by watching the entire series on PBS Passport, a new member benefit from your local PBS station. You can watch select Masterpiece titles like Poldark, Downton Abbey, or Victoria as part of the Passport experience. To learn more, visit pbs.org/getpassport. You can also follow along with us on the PBS Masterpiece Prime video channel, available as an add-on service to your Amazon Prime membership. Mining Poldark is hosted by me, Barrett Brontes, with co-host Robin Ellis. We're produced by Nick Anderson, with help from Robin Bissett. Meredith Wheeler is our field producer. Tina Toby Mack is our sound designer. Suzanne Simpson is our executive producer. The executive producer of Masterpiece is Rebecca Eaton. Sponsors for Masterpiece on PBS are Viking, Raymond James, and the Masterpiece Trust. Poldark is a Mammoth Screen production for BBC, co-produced with Masterpiece.